introduce our main speaker for this evening, Joe S. from San Diego.
My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really grateful to be here tonight. So I got to tell you what the last half hour was like for me. So Larry Lay, who I know from a men's meeting that I go to on Sundays, called me about a month ago, 5 weeks ago, and asked me if I could speak here that subsequent Saturday night. And I told him I couldn't do it. I got a busy life, got two kids, et cetera, and I was gone for the subsequent 3-4 weekends. And at that time, which is back in February, I said I could probably do it April 9th. And that's the last we spoke about it until 7:30 tonight. So, my kids are out. My son's down at Mission Bay with some friends. He's 14, almost 14 next week. At a bonfire, my daughter, she's 16 and a half. She's with her boyfriend. And my wife and I had just sat down, literally just opened up the styrofoam to 3 rolls of sushi to sit down and eat. And I get the phone call from Larry. And he says, I hope you remember the April 9th, bud. You're going to be there? And I said, shit, Larry, we never confirmed it. And so I know Larry's been a busy guy. He's got a lot of good things going on in his life, and same for me. And I probably should have confirmed with him. So we scrambled, got my daughter to pick up my son, and actually her boyfriend's going to pick him up. And I told him I'll be here, and here I am. So this is truly coming from the heart because I did not have any time to prepare for this at all, at all. And all those things, though, my son, and my wife is here, too, so I got to talk to Larry, and he owes her a sushi dinner as well. Anyways, my sobriety date is October 17th, 1991. So I've been sober for just over 24, almost 24 and a half years. And there's a part of the 12 and 12 that rings true to me when I hear it in step one. It says, it is a tremendous satisfaction to record that in the following years, this changed. Alcoholics who still had their health, their families, their jobs, and even 2 cars in the garage began to recognize their alcoholism. As this trend grew, they were joined by young people who were scarcely more than potential alcoholics. They were spared that last 10 or 15 years of literal hell the rest of us had gone through. Since step one requires an admission that our lives have become unmanageable, how could people such as these take this step? And it goes on to talk about basically associating yourself with an alcoholic, regardless of whether you're Skid Row or whether you come from Beverly Hills, whether you're 21 years old or 75 getting sober. You know, it's what we do when we drink. And what I was going to say is my wife, who's sober 30-plus years, my 2 kids, none of them ever seen me drink, which is a miracle for me. And we've been together for coming up on 19 years, I think. 22 years we've known each other, but we're married for almost 19 years. And so I to start off, so I grew up in the East Coast, Boston, and my parents are alcoholics. They got sober when I was 6. My dad got sober when I was 6. My mother had just gotten sober before him. But they came from a long line of alcoholics, and so my lineage is alcoholism all the way through. And my mother's family was in the beer business, and so there was a lot of accessibility to beer. And a typical Saturday barbecue at my family's house was my Uncle Benny was the fire chief at my hometown, Natick, Massachusetts. And he would get so drunk that he would literally at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I think he was wearing his full fire gear, you know, it was like his chief gear, and he would just fall over and just fall on the ground, completely passed out at 2 o'clock from drinking Budweiser. And nobody made a big deal out of it. They'd prop him back up, lean him over, put a beer in his hands, and just let him fall asleep for 3 or 4 hours, and the rest of the party would go on. And that was an atmosphere that was pretty common in my upbringing. And I'm here, and I wish I had seen some people before I start to speak, but I see a few people, Stuart and George and other people I know from other meetings, so I'm really glad to see you guys. So I grew up with AA. So by the time I had turned 21, able to drink, two of my three sisters were already sober as well. So AA was in my life from the very beginning. It was big books. 12 and 12s were in my parents' car all the time. My parents, all their friends were sober friends. They had people come to our house for coffee. They would hang out and talk. So that was the atmosphere that I grew up with at Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was always a conflict. So I started drinking when I was just over 15 and a half. And my sister, if anyone remembers, we used to stand in line for concert tickets, right? And so I remember standing in line for these concerts with my sister. And she had some friends, and one of these guys came by, and they brought some Budweisers. I'd had sips of my dad's beer in the past. He used to drink Schlitz malt liquor, all right? Back there, it's Schlitz malt liquor. You know, that was like, you know, what you drank back in Boston. And but never really, you know, I didn't know if it had an effect. But the first time I really had an effect was at 15 and a half, and this guy brought a Budweiser, and and just to mind, let you know what I weighed at that time. When I was in high school, I was a junior. I wrestled at 114 pounds. When I was a senior, I wrestled at 121. So I was always a real little guy. Couldn't handle my alcohol very much at all. But I remember specifically the effect I had when I drank that Budweiser. It was like, it put it to rest. It made me give that sense of ease and comfort that I had been searching for. The atmosphere I grew up with my family was a lot of violence. Even though my parents got sober, it was dysfunction. There was a lot of shouting. I grew up in a family of just screamers. My dad, even though he was sober, would a couple of incidences that it's hard for me to talk about, hard for me to remember, hard for me to write in my four-step. Some violent actions. I remember my dad pulling my mother's hair. I remember one time my dad shoving my sister down. You know, the typical thing, my mother would get out of the car in the middle of him driving and just say, I'm going to walk home, and he'd be screaming and get in the car. And this is all in sobriety. So, and, you know, I love my dad, and I love my parents. And had it not been for their sobriety and the example that they gave to me and my sisters, and I have another sister who could be in here or not, that's her decision. So I have three older sisters, two are sober. But just the action of being sober, going to meetings, having a community of fellowship, it was an example of what I needed when ultimately came time for me to get sober. So I had that beer when I was 15 and a half, and I remember calling my friend and saying, listen, I just had some Budweiser, and we got to get more of this stuff. And that's what we did, and we just chased Budweiser. And I know I shared here the last time I shared it. I was a 10-minute speaker, and I don't think I'm supposed to drop F-bombs or swear. Is that like kind of the rule here? But I remember the last time I spoke here, I was swearing, dropping all these F-bombs, and there was a woman in the back shaking her head. I'm thinking, well, she's really relating to me. You know, I'm like, I really get it. And then I realized somebody told me, hey, you're not supposed to swear in this meeting. So, but the point of our drinking very early on was we used to call it getting all effed up. I mean, that was the goal, was to just get all effed up as quickly as we could. And so we progressed from beer to hard alcohol and gin and vodka. And so now I'm, you know, 16, 17 years old. And I was the guy who would be the volunteer to stand in front of liquor stores and ask people to buy us liquor. So that was the progression pretty quickly for me to what I was chasing. And I had no problem doing that. For some reason, I didn't. It was like no big deal. I would stand in front of liquor stores in Framingham, Mass, and, hey, can you buy me some vodka? No, next guy, buy me some vodka. And we'd get some vodka for the night, and we'd go do it. And that's how it set up a lot of things for me to really start to abusing alcohol. And I didn't know that I had set up, that I had an alcoholic mind and an alcoholic body at the time, but the progression was such that ultimately I started to become a blackout drinker. And very quickly, by the time I was about 18, 19 years old, I was blacking out pretty regularly. When we would go out and drink, I was the guy that blacked out. Or I would really try to control my drinking, and I'd have three or four, and I was the most sober of my friends, and I would be the guy driving drunk to get my friends home. So it was just alcohol. We didn't do a lot of drugs. We smoked some pot, did some mushrooms here and there, but cocaine, heroin, nothing like that was part of my story at all. So continuing to drink, I eventually went to school, went to college, and anyone knows at college, it really glorifies alcohol and alcohol abuse, and I got into that pretty easily. And I went to school for engineering, and it was an extremely stressful major. And this was the cycle, is that I would drink a lot, party, blackout, stop, crash for an exam, take the exam, go the next day, be psyched that I took the exam, passed it, drink. You know, that was the pattern that I set up. So when my sponsor, and I'm going to jump a little ahead here, when he talked to me about the first step, he talked that I had a mental obsession and a physical allergy. And the mental obsession, for me, like, I have these experiences that I can relate to in my life. Like, even at, like, 16, 17 years old, I remember coming home from work, having already been drinking for a couple of years. And it was a Friday night. And for some reason, I remember this one distinctly. I used to paint houses with my dad. He was a teacher, so we had a painting business in the summertime. And so I come home from work on a Friday night, and I knew that we had some beers coming. We had some cases, and we had some alcohol, some vodka. And I was getting ready to get in the shower, and I was cranking some music. I was cranking that song, Mississippi Queen by Mountain. And I remember feeling such a rush. Like, I was so psyched that I was going to go get effed up. And that obsession and just that thought process was with me all day long, because I was just going to get hammered that night. And that's the type of thinking that I had a lot in my late teens. And it was good. Like, I didn't think that was a big deal. I thought that was a normal thing to do, because I was hanging around with a bunch of people who had that same mentality. And what I didn't realize is that was the mental obsession that I was starting to progress into my life. And then, of course, the physical allergy. If you go out and try to have a couple of beers and you black out, obviously you suffer from a physical allergy. But I hadn't got to that point. I wasn't trying to not black out at that point. But back to being in college, my drinking caught up with me very, very quickly. And I ended up blacking out a lot. And I surrounded myself with a lot of people who drank like I did, and young guys. And I didn't think it was that big a deal for a while. And then I started to get kind of scared. And then the person who I thought was an alcoholic in my life, he was my roommate in college, he said to me, "Dude, I think you're an alcoholic." And in my mind, I'm like, you know, you're the alcoholic, I'm not the alcoholic, you know, and it started to get conflicts. And then in the meantime, I had this whole growing up with an AA. So I had a head full of AA and a belly full of booze from the time I was first started drinking. And my mother must have known that there was something going on, because when I was about 22 years old, she gave me this book, the 24 Hours a Day book. All right, and that's and I haven't read that in a long time, but it's AA thought for the day, right? And then there's a meditation for the day, and there's a prayer for the day. And as I was starting to realize that I had a problem with alcohol, as people started saying to me, "I think you're an alcoholic," my girlfriend says, "I think you have a problem with alcohol," I started to realize maybe I don't want to go out and start blacking out. Maybe I should try to control this a little bit more. And that's when I really started to get the conflict of realizing that I couldn't control my drinking anymore. And I was looking for a spiritual solution my whole life. I really was. I really felt that it was. And I grew up in a Catholic upbringing, Boston Irish Catholic. And I'd made a connection when I was, you know, a young kid. But by the time, coincidentally, right about the time I started drinking, I stopped going to church, and I didn't want anything to do with church. And but I still tried to search. My sister was reading books, and she gave me books, and I tried to read other things to try to make a connection. But like we say here in AA, in order to start the spiritual connection, you have to put down the drink. And I was still drinking. But back to the 24 Hours a Day book. So I would read the meditation for the day and the prayer for the day, but I would never read AA thought for the day, because I was afraid to relate to being an alcoholic. I didn't want to admit that I was an alcoholic, because if I was going to admit I was an alcoholic, I was going to have to come to these meetings for the rest of my life, because my parents did that for 40-plus years. My dad's 40-plus years sober. And it was a fearful experience for me. I was conflicted. I was hiding my alcohol. I was then I was the point where I was afraid to wake up in the morning. I'd get up, and I was afraid to get out of my bed, because I was afraid of what I did the night before. I was afraid who I spoke to. I was afraid when I drove. I did a lot of driving and blacking out. And And I really started, the fear that we feel as alcoholics really started to come into my life. And I was riddled with fear for the next 3 or 4 years. And I come to realize after doing an inventory that I had been fearful my whole life, really. And it says that we have 100 forms of fear. And when I did my inventory with my sponsor, I could only list maybe, I don't know, 15. So subconscious fears were ruling me. You know, I was really suffering from fear. And I was using alcohol to help me feel better, but the alcohol was creating more fear, and I was on that cycle. And, excuse me. So, the last couple years of my drinking, it was a situation where I would stay sober for a couple weeks, then I would binge drink, and I would be off and running for a couple weeks. And then I would stay sober for a couple weeks, and then I would binge drink for a couple more weeks because I knew, I felt like intuitively that I had crossed that line that I'd never thought I wanted to cross. Like, I never wanted to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be like my parents. I didn't want to be like my Uncle Benny. I didn't want to be like my Uncle Hal. I mean, all the way down the line. And but inside, I knew, and I started to play with it a little bit and say, at, you know, at parties, hey, I'm an alcoholic, and joke about it. Hey, I'm an alcoholic, and joke about it. But towards the end, I started to not joke about it because I really started to be afraid of my drinking. And the biggest fear that I had was that I was going to kill a family while I was driving in a blackout, and it just terrified the hell out of me. And so I'll tell you, I've never been arrested, and I've never had a DUI. And that kept me from coming in here for a number of years. You know, I did get sober when I was 24, a week after I was 24, but I was thinking, like, I got to go deeper before I can finally admit I'm an alcoholic. But meanwhile, I'm just riddled with this fear. I'm just anxious all the time, and I'm drinking a lot, and I'm blacking out. And, you know, in the part in the big book where, and this, I didn't know about any of this until I came into AA. Even though my parents were sober, you know, it was kind of funny, like, I'd be in the back, my friends would be in the back seat, and we'd be pounding beers and smoking joints, and there'd be a big book and a 12 and 12 between both of them, and then, you know, they're like, what is this? I don't know, just throw it in the back, you know, and little did I know the solution was in the back seat the entire time. But, you know, when I met with a sponsor, and he said, we're going to read the book. And I read the doctor's opinion with him. And I'd been sober. I'm jumping up ahead a little bit, but I just want to, I can really relate to this at that time of my drinking because stopping, starting. It says that men and women, the doctor's opinion, okay, and this was one of the most impactful things that I read when I got sober. It was probably about 11 months after when I met the sponsor who changed my life. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive, while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. So after they succumb to desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. So that was it. Like, I was, so that point, by towards the end of it, I was thinking, I'm not going to drink. I got to stay sober. I'm afraid to get in the car in a blackout. And I was trying to find ways to stay sober. I was counting bottle caps. I was working out. I was finding different girlfriends. I was hanging out with different people. I was blowing my friends off, saying, I'm just going to stay home tonight. You know, no matter what I did. And I was staying sober for a little period of time. But then the mental obsession kicked in, the phenomenon of craving develops, then I drink again, I pass through that well-known stages of a spree with a firm resolution not to drink again. I'm done. And I had some pretty horrendous hangovers. I remember, well, I'll tell a couple of funny stories. So this is when I'm bargaining with my alcohol, right? I'm thinking like, okay, what can I eat before I drink? What can I do to keep from blacking out? A friend told me, eat eggs before you drink, all right? I don't know if they have the beer back here, but there was a beer back in Massachusetts. It was called Heffenreffer, and it was a malt liquor. And it was 16 ounces, so it was great. You can get a 12-pack of 16 ounces. and then you could then get a bottle of schnapps on eggs, right? So, I mean, this is a typical story of what happened to me. So I'm going to see The Clash, all right? And Combat Rock, you know, there was that album, right? And then we start drinking. I have my eggs in me, all right? We start drinking on the way there. A couple of Heffenreffers on the way, down to Worcester, three or four, and then we're drinking. You know how it is, you're driving, then you get out of the car and you realize you can't stand up. I'm drinking more and more. I black out. I come to in the concert. I'm puking up all over the seat in front of me. I missed the whole concert. I have just a faint vision of Joe Strummer like running across the stage and Mick Jones, and that was it. Like, I don't remember anything about the concert. And this was February in Boston. I don't know if you've been to Massachusetts in February, but it's freaking cold. And I had a short sleeve shirt on, you know, because I want to show my guns off, right? And meanwhile, I'm like 100, at that point, maybe 118, right? And so I stumble outside, and I go outside, and then once you go out, you can't come in, right? So I've got a T-shirt on, short sleeve shirt, February, it's probably 20 degrees out. And I'm completely messed up, and I keep putting my foot in the door of people that leaving and coming back because the heat kept coming out. So I kept trying to get heat from inside so I could heat up on the outside, right? And then I'm looking for all the cars that had just turned their engine off, and I'm laying up on the hoods, you know, to try to get warm like that. And then my friends come out, they grab me, and we go do it, all right? And I did this over and over. So then I wake up, and I'm like, I'm never going to drink again. There's no way I could drink again, right? A firm resolution not to drink again, right? You know, similar stories over and over again. Like, I went down with my friends from Massachusetts. We went to D.C. to see the Amnesty International concert. It was an all-day concert. I'm in the parking lot. I black out at, like, 10 o'clock in the morning. I mean, everybody's playing there. It was Bruce Springsteen, Peter Gabriel. I mean, all these huge bands. I think U2 was playing. This is like, 1989. And I'm huddled in the corner of RFK Stadium, laying down on the ground, puking my guts up. People are walking around me, and this is like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's like at least like 8 more hours of the concert. I lost my friends. I drove there. I'm the one who drove. And I finally hook up with them, and the next day I was so sick. I was just so sick. I had thrown up so much that I had burned my esophagus so badly, and I had pulled muscles in my stomach so hard that I couldn't stand up for like 3 or 4 days. It was like the ultimate workout, you know. It was like for my stomach. And I had that firm resolution. There's no way I can drink again. And I did this over and over and over again. And I was just so sick. And I would get so violently sick towards the end of my drinking. But I hadn't been arrested, and I didn't have a DUI. So my mind's thinking, okay, where am I? I moved to California after I got out of school with an engineering degree. I got hired by Caltrans, and I moved to Redondo Beach with my buddies that I was partying with and drinking with and smoking pot with. And so this was August of 1991, and I really felt like if I had moved to California, and it wasn't like I had this belief like it's a true geographic, because I had graduated from college, I got a degree, and I was going to start my career. But I really thought like, okay, this is going to be a change, you know? This is going to be a separation in my life where I could really start something different and not drink like I was drinking. And it's like it says, the old man will drink again, right? If you don't change, you're not going to drink. And so it says, like, remorseful, the firm loss not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless the person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. And I hadn't had a psychic change. I just moved. And so this is August. Progressed. And so what happened was I was working on the Harbor Freeway, and we would work at night. And I don't know if everyone knows the bridge that runs from Gage to downtown. And so there was this big formwork that we would drop every Saturday night, and we would move it down to the next band, and then it was a succession of building the bridge. And on Saturday nights, they would run this this net across the freeway to prevent people from running through the closure and then hitting the people that are working, because they're walking around on the freeway, people are driving their pickup trucks with the assumption that nobody's going to be driving on the freeway. Well, I came to work that next day on a Monday. Meanwhile, I didn't change. I was still drinking. I was still blacking out. I was still partying with my friends. I was still driving them drunk. I was driving other people around in a blackout. This was really, I was really getting afraid of my activities and what I was going to do to people. Well, this kid, 21 years old, had blown through that closure at about 100 miles an hour, and he went down on the freeway, and he hit the dead portion of a man lift. So a guy's up in the basket up above finishing the bridge. They got like maybe a 300-pound weight. And he hit that, and he died instantly. And his battery, they said, was like 100 yards down the road, and the car stopped short. And he was killed immediately. And I didn't know about this until Monday. And Monday, I hear about it, and I was like, it hit me like an effing ton of bricks. I was like, holy shit, that is me. I mean, I'm that kid. I'm no different from that kid. I'm going to – and my biggest fear at that point was I got a beautiful wife. I got two kids now. I'm going to kill a family just like I have now. And that's what I was totally afraid of. And I was realizing that I just couldn't stop my drinking, no matter what I did. And so I called my sister at that time, who had been sober about 6 years, and she said – this is a so that was a Monday – so this was instrumental. So after that fear, after this firm resolution not to drink again, I'm not going to drink again. Monday, stay sober. Tuesday, stay sober. Wednesday, I have a couple of beers. Thursday, my buddies are going out. No, I don't want to go out. Just come on. No, I don't want to go out. You know, then the mental obsession kicks in, right? Like, I didn't have the strength. I didn't have the power. I mean, this is so subtle, baffling, and powerful, right? Like, it talks about the guy who crossed the threshold and he thought a highball sounded good with dinner, right? Or the guy who puts the alcohol in a glass of milk. Like, the insanity to think that that's acceptable, but there's no power behind that to prevent the action from going forward. And that's what I had. I didn't have the action. I didn't have the power. So Thursday night, I said, okay, I'll go out. And then I go out and I have a couple beers, have more beers. I'm drinking. I didn't black out, but I come home, I just can't stop drinking. So I called on my sister that Friday night, and I said, listen, I'm jumping ahead. So Friday night, I come home from work, I'm driving home, it's about 4 o'clock, and then it really hit me. We talk about having, really having it in your gut, and really having the experience of knowing that you're an alcoholic. And it was about 5 o'clock on a Friday, October 17th, I guess, because it was my first day of sobriety, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I had to pull over, and I just was overwhelmed with the idea that I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink, and I didn't know what to do, and I was afraid that if I went home, I was going to drink, and I was afraid to not drink because I needed to drink to feel comfortable, but I was afraid of what I was doing. So I called my sister, and she said, go to AA. There's a meeting, I'm guarantee you, on a Friday night. Get a big book, sit down, listen. Don't get up and walk around. Get some phone numbers after the meeting. Meet some people and keep going to meetings. And I honestly, 24 years later, this is what I do. I go to meetings, you know. Some people, I don't know who's here, raise their hands as a newcomer, who took chips, whatever, but there was a mystery to me, people that had stayed sober a long time. And truthfully, the reality is I've just gone to meetings. That's not all I've done, but I've continuously gone to meetings over my sobriety, and I haven't lost a connection to the program. So that's what I did. I jumped in. I started meeting guys. I mobbed up. We started going to a lot of meetings together. I stayed sober for about 10, 11 months. I was still working for Caltrans at the time. They moved me to Sacramento, which they say you're not supposed to move in your first year. I moved. Turns out, I ran into a guy who, I heard him share, he had about 5 years of sobriety. About 2 years prior to that, he was about to commit suicide. He was going through a divorce. He hadn't worked any steps. So when he had about 3 years, he hadn't worked any steps. He was bone dry. He didn't have a power in his life. He didn't have the steps in his life. And he met a guy who changed his life, basically took the steps off the wall, put him into his life, and he had a spiritual experience. So basically he had the psychic change that gave him the ability to stop drinking and to change. And so this gentleman, and he'd never been to that meeting before, and I'd never been to that meeting before, and neither one of ever went since. So, you know, I consider that God working in my life. And so he carried me through the steps, and I did the first step, and I just, you know, went through the portion of the doctor's opinion that was so impactful to me. You know, it says, on the other hand, as strange as though this may seem to those who don't understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he had a spirit of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And he laid out the rules for me. And we started going through the steps. And I started hanging out with these other guys that were similar. They had a calamitous situation in sobriety. They hadn't worked steps. And they had gone through a transformation while they were sober. And that's kind of how I worked my second step. The God of my upbringing, it was a fearful God. It was a God that was imposed on me. It was a God that said, you're going to go to hell. You got to do things this way. And I was completely afraid of that God. He told me there's a God out there, there's a power out there for you, specific to you, that's loving, that's kind, that's patient, that's going to help you, that's going to take care of you. And I saw these guys working the steps, the second step, and I related to these guys because they were going through some of the situations but they were staying sober. So the program in itself became a higher power for me for a while, and then I ultimately became, God started working my life. So we went through the third step, I turned my will and my life over, and he said the rest of the steps is how you turn your will and your life over, and I did a fourth step, fifth step, cleaned house. And I did the six and seven, but I'll be honest with you, it wasn't until probably the last 7 or 8 years that I really understood defects, instincts, and how they can control my life. So I did my amends. I went in. I paid people off. I went into stores where I stole. I went in with cash. I went into places that I worked that I gave away a bunch of free electronics. I took a bunch for myself. You know, it was high enough that it would have been a felony if they wanted it to be. And that's when I really started to change in the ninth step, because I went into these places with cash, and I said, I'm sober 13 months. I stole while I worked here. I owe you this amount of money. I have the money in my pocket. Who can I talk to? And they'd say, hold on. You know, it seemed like an eternity. And they'd come back, and the security guard would come like walking like all the way down the aisle, and I'm just praying my ass off the whole time. And they say, please follow us. And I go back into the back room, praying my ass off the whole time. And they say, you know, honestly, what you did is so long ago. We have no record of what you did. There's no way for us to reconcile anything. Stay sober. Do what you want with the money. And I had these multiple experiences when I started making my amends. And the funny thing is, I called my parents up and I told them how much I owed them. And they said, okay, we'll put you on a payment plan. So... And no shit, I had to figure out how much I owed my parents, and I paid them back on a monthly basis. You know, they were sober, right? So they knew that it was good for me. So I moved back to Redondo Beach. I met my wife. We actually met on a blind date at Disneyland. From my sponsor and her sponsor were married, and they said, hey, I know a cute girl, and she said, I know a cute guy, and we went, we met, and we've been together for 22 years. Yeah, so, and I have an amazing life today. I really do. I have an incredible life. And my first sponsor, he always was very adamant about continuing going to meetings and about giving this thing back in as many ways as I can. And he said one of the most selfish things that I could do as a sober alcoholic is to get sober, have a spiritual experience, and then leave AA. He says you need to give this thing away to keep it and to continue to have this in your life. So I have the sponsor I have now. It's a different sponsor, the same sponsor I've had for 20 years now. And he's been incredibly impactful in my life as well. Of course, my wife has been sober 30 years, so we talk a lot of sobriety. But I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here because I get about 8 minutes or so. And, you know, if you're going to stay sober for a little while, things come and go. The connection comes and goes. The attraction for AA comes and goes. The continuing to go to meetings comes and goes. You know, sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's not so great. But you got to keep at it, you know, to have the life you want. But about 6 years ago, I had 19 years of sobriety, and I had a lot of anger, and I didn't know it. I still had a lot of anger left, and it wasn't like I was. I had moments of rage, most certainly, and I had a lot of uncomfortability still. And I've gone through the steps. I've done inventories. I've made amends. I've done 10 steps. I sponsored guys. I'm going to meetings. I tried meditating. But I was at a point where I was having a tough time. And my sponsor, a couple years prior, had lost his stepson. His stepson was 18 years old and just collapsed in the shower and just died instantly. And he had been sober, I don't know how many years by that point. And it really rocked him to the core. And how he sought relief was by really diving into the 11th step, into meditation. And so he'd been meditating quite a bit by the time I'd called him, that 6 years ago. And I called him up and I said, Pete, I'm just having a tough time, man. And I communicated with him a lot. I mean, I called him on a weekly basis, but, you know, I'm Irish, I'm from Boston, I'm Catholic. I don't let people in too easily. You know, I put up the front pretty quickly. I'm good. Yeah, I'm good. I'm doing okay. But that stuff only works so long. And I said, Pete, you know, I'm messed up. I got a lot of anger. And he said, Joe, what you need to do, and he says, you need to effing meditate. And he says, take 3 breaths, hang up the phone, take 3 breaths, and call me back. So I hung up the phone, and I'm like, you know? And that's kind of like, I was like, okay, I'm going to meditate, you know? I call him back. But really, it was like I breathed in, and I breathed out. And I breathed in, and I breathed out. And I breathed in, and I breathed out. And I called him back. He says, how'd that feel? And I said, you know, things started to change. I started to feel a little bit better, you know, just in those 2 or 3 minutes. And he says, what you need to do is you need to make a daily practice of the 11th step in your life. And you need to, however you want to do it, but you need to start developing a meditation practice. And so what's happened is I started with those 3 breaths. And then I went to a couple minutes sitting in a chair. And then I went to about 3 minutes sitting in a chair. And then I progressed and I started incrementally increasing the amount of time. And I started getting involved with groups that he was involved with where we would meditate for a period of time. And then, you know, now what happens in my life is now on a regular basis, I consistently, not every single day, but most days, I sit and I meditate for about 20 minutes. But what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years is I become really in tune with instincts and how instincts can really drive me. Instincts of lust, instincts of anger, instincts of pride, instincts of fear, sloth. I mean, it says, you know, God-given but driven for me to do my own will, self-will, not God-will. And I really had to look at why was I so angry? And even though I had done the inventories, even though I had put my mother down there, I put my father down there for pulling her here, my mother down there for sleeping all day, for not being there when I needed her, for various reasons, for the bullies next door, for being 114 pounds and being picked on, for being 121 pounds and being picked on, for being bullied, for the girl, my girlfriend who told me, that you're an alcoholic. I mean, all these things, I'd done all that stuff. But I didn't really get in touch, really, to the voices that I still had in my head that still told me that you're no good, that you shouldn't be here. What are you doing? At your job, you're lucky to even be there. You drank your way through college. You're lucky to even be an engineer, all right? These things were still going on in my head. And I had to realize that I had, at that point, 19, 20 years of sobriety. I had done a lot of good things in my life. I had to start tapping into a lot of that and overshadowing all those negative voices in my head that were still there years later. And so when I meditate, I was able to go back to a lot of those situations, a lot of those violent situations in my life, and not be afraid to look at them, to willingly go into those experiences in a meditative state, knowing that I had a power with me that was going to take care of me, and start really healing those experiences in my life and really going back and really seeing what my dad was doing. Hell, if I had four kids, I was a teacher, I had a teacher's salary, I painted houses, I would have drank too, you know? I mean, and my mother was an alcoholic too. I mean, there's a lot of things. So a lot of things started to make sense. A lot of healing started to make sense. A lot of forgiveness started to make sense. And that forgiveness really is something that I've started to have for myself. I've been able to feel more comfortable in my skin. I've been able to forgive myself for things that I did to others and still do. And the messages in my head now, and, you know, my wife, we've been together for 22 years, so she's seen this progression, you know. And when I first started meditating, and my benchmarks were, well, I didn't blow up on my kids today, you know. I mean, you start raising kids, and you got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, I mean, it's stressful, you know. And you're working, and you're trying to stay married, and you're trying to go to meetings. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity to lose your cool. But over time, what I've been able to do is really start to step back and really realize that that is not productive. It's not productive to me. It's not productive to them. And I've been able to be in touch with the God inside of me that wants me to be happy, joyous, and free, that wants me to be sober, that wants me to be love, that wants me to give this thing away. And I do believe that I've rounded off. The edges have just been shaved down. I believe I have a lot more peace in my life. I believe that I'm a lot more comfortable in my skin. What's happening is work. I've become somebody who people come to, and I give them advice. And sometimes it still comes in. I go, oh, my God, if they only knew I was that guy that was puking his guts out at the Clash concert, you know? And then I just, you know, God's will. And am I almost out of time or what?
We're
out of time. Okay. So when we're getting ready to eat sushi, and we're going to go home and eat it because it's in the refrigerator, we're going to heat up the edamame, and Larry says, hey, buddy, where are you? You're supposed to be there. And I'm like, shit. And I got to be honest, I didn't reach out to Larry. After he said, hey, can you do this? And I told him back 6 weeks, 5 weeks ago, the only date I can do is April 9th. We never spoke. I was hoping he never called me, all right? You know, I'm just being honest. And I wasn't going to remind him, hey, I said April 9th, you know? And it was an act of omission on my part. And so what happens is my wife, she was going to do something, and then it got canceled, and she was going to come here tonight. And then I said, well, he never called me. I didn't, you know, this is like last week, you know, Monday, Tuesday. I guess I'm not speaking, you know, of course not reaching out. But when he called me, he says, hey, bud, where are you? And I said, I'll be there, you know, I'll do it. And so we just closed it up, and it was pretty damn stressful. We were yelling at each other, and she's like, well, shit, who's going to pick up the kids? Well, I don't know. I want you to be there. Well, my daughter can't pick him up because it's illegal for her to drive my son, you know, and let's get the boyfriend to pick her up. And it was just like a lot of insanity in like 3 minutes. But you know, I came, and I'm here, and I'm really grateful to be here. And, you know, this is probably better that I didn't think about this for 6 weeks. You know, I actually had about an 10-minute ride to get here and think, okay, just say a prayer and just do the best you can. So thanks for keeping me sober tonight. Thanks.